Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, greetings from the mean streets of Las Vegas. Satchmo rolling at you on Sparty Talk. Joined in a moment by the one, the only, the Thin Man DB to talk about Michigan State, Michigan. That's right. Rivalry weekend is here. The Spartans are getting ready to play the Wolverines. Here to talk about that is the one, the only Thin Man DB. Greetings, DB.
Greetings and salutations, Spartan Nation. Ready to take on the Wolverine.
Ready to take on the Wolverine. You know, I just get the sense that right now there are lines, like, out the door at Walmart of Wolverine fans buying merchandise because they've never been to the student bookstore in Ann Arbor.
They don't know how to read.
No, they don't know how to read. They're lucky they know how to drive.
They don't know what a bookstore is. Their bookstore is YouTube.
Yeah. The bookstore is that place they used to buy cigarettes from.
Their bookstore is youporn.com.
Oh, it must be Michigan week if we're trolling the opposition, right?
Yes.
Yes, that's the only logical explanation for it. Must be Michigan if we're trolling the opposition. It's a weird sort of game, DB, because usually, you know, you could say, you could put this game in context and say this game means something for either school. And right now, I'm not sure what this game means for Michigan State, and I'm not sure what this game means for Michigan. How do you sort of look at this game, DB?
Well, I think, you know, it's never overstated. This is a rivalry game, and any rivalry game is very important. And this, you know, where the Michigan fans want to admit it or not, sometimes they don't. Michigan State is their number one rival. And so I think each team understands, the players understand, that this is a huge game. It's very important. I think, what does it mean for the rivalry itself? Michigan won last year, so they got that off their back. If they were going into this game without a win against Mark D'Antonio, they would probably be really, really hungry for it. They want to beat the Spartans at home because they haven't done that a whole lot in the last, you know, 7 or 8 years. The Spartans want to continue their winning ways. It's been 7 of the last 9 for Mark D'Antonio against Michigan. So, you know, it always means a lot, but in the grand scheme of the Big Ten season, actually, I think, you tell me what you think, Satchmo, but I think a loss here hurts Michigan a whole lot more, considering their place in the standings, than it does Michigan State this season.
Yeah, this is really weird. I mean, you summed up the rivalry nicely, right? Mr. D'Antonio's won 7 out of 9. Harbaugh's 1-1 and would like to go to 2-1. Michigan State would like to halt the slide at 1. And so, and then obviously you're playing for bragging rights. And so that's what this means to the rivalry. What it means to the program is something completely different. In many ways, this game is more important for the University of Michigan. It's more important for the Wolverines than it is for Michigan State. And the reason behind that is this is a Michigan team that is expected, for better or worse, expected to contend for a Big Ten championship and for a national championship. And this is a Michigan team that is expected to compete for Big Ten championships and national championships. And if you take, if they lose to Michigan State tomorrow, you take that out of the equation. All of a sudden, Harbaugh is 1-2 against Michigan State, their number one rival, whether they like to admit it or not. And he's only won one game against the combination of Ohio State and Michigan State during his tenure here. And his one win came in a dumpster fire of the season that Michigan State had last year. So when you take it all into account in terms of what it means for the program, I think this game is probably more important for Michigan and Harbaugh than it is for Michigan State. The question is, what does this mean to Michigan State? Well, in the grand scheme of things, it means, or be validation, DB, that Michigan State is back on the right path. And we tend to see that, right? We're noticing improved play, improved talent on the field, better locker room, better leadership. There's a quarterback in place. And so more and more the signs point to, yeah, last year was a blip on the road. But a win here gets them one game closer to bowl eligibility. It doesn't make all the warts on this team go away, and there are warts, but it gives them one game closer to bowl eligibility, one game closer to the postseason, and it affirms the path that Michigan State is on. If they lose the game, it doesn't destroy the path Michigan State's on, but, you know, it says, all right, let's see how we do next week. This season's going to be every bit the struggle we thought it was going to be. Whereas a win this week says, all right, maybe we're going to arrive at that finish point a little sooner than we thought.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think going into this game this year, I don't think the Spartans are expected to win this game. I mean, there are certain games on the Spartans' schedule this year. This one and Penn State and Ohio State, you know, the Spartans aren't expected to win those games.
Yeah, I agree with that. Do you notice, and I know this is tending me, I tend to get a little more mouthy when Michigan State isn't as good, and when Michigan State's better, I just, like, wait for them to put the thing on the field. Have you noticed that? I'm just more annoyed with Michigan fans now than usually.
I'm always annoyed with them. I think last year might have been the first time in the Mark D'Antonio era where I just didn't even want to watch the game. It felt like John L. Smith because of the season we were having. I mean, we were pretty low. You know, when you think about last year's Michigan game going into East Lansing, the Spartans were so bad. And by that point in the season, it was sort of like, well, you know, how much worse could it get? I mean, we thought, I think, if you go back to that podcast, we thought that Michigan would probably storm into East Lansing and just destroy us. The Spartans ended up playing a little bit closer. Jim Harbaugh might have taken his foot off the gas pedal in that game. I don't know. But I feel a sense of confidence again with Michigan State. My heart believes that the Spartans could win the game, but my head is telling me I'm not sure.
Yeah, I've got a similar thing. My heart believes there's a chance in a low-scoring game. There's a reasonable shot at doing it. Michigan State pulling off a 16-13 game. And it's based on three factors. And then it will get to my head, which says Michigan is faster, deeper, stronger, and should win this game going away. But we'll begin with the heart. This game is going to turn on three matchups, DB. The first matchup is the Michigan State defensive line against what appears to be a shaky University of Michigan offensive line. If the Michigan State defensive line can play as well as it did against Iowa, as well as it did against a pretty good Western Michigan team with a pretty good offensive line, and generate pressure and disrupt plays, you can see the elements there for a low-scoring game. The second matchup that I view as critical is sort of the opposite, which is the offensive line of Michigan State versus the defensive line of Michigan. And there is no denying that this is an extremely talented Michigan defensive line. And there's no denying that that Michigan State has struggled to run the ball, primarily because their offensive line has struggled to block. And so can this offensive line do it? And the reason why it's so important, DB, is Brian Lewerke is a good quarterback, but he's not ready to carry this football team. He just isn't. He's a young quarterback. He's getting better every game. The improvements are there, but he's not at a point where you can throw it 35, 40 times. And I understand why people were frustrated with the play calling last week, but Lewerke can't do that. He locks on receivers. He doesn't make his reads. He can't throw the ball to the outside. All things he's getting better at, but he's not in a position to carry the team. And so you've got that. And then the final question you have is, can Michigan State's young but talented receiving corps exploit the Michigan secondary, which has been ordinary to point to today? I think they can, but I'm not sure whether they can hold up. So my heart says, you want to know what? There's a lot of elements in place that say this is going to be a close game. Then my head says, you want the only team that they really played with this level of talent was Notre Dame. And even though they sort of outplayed them, Notre Dame was able to turn it on and off against Michigan State at will. And the Michigan defense is really outstanding. And Lewerke has to put together a full 40 or so minutes. So I don't know, DB. My heart says Michigan State can win. My head says Michigan is at this point a better team. I think next year and the year after that, the next 2 years, Michigan State will win both games. I'm willing to mark that down right now. Michigan State wins the next two games in this series. I'm not comfortable with this year, though.
Whoa, Satchmo going way out on a limb all the way to 2019 in Ann Arbor.
Absolutely. Next two games, mark it down.
Well, look, that's far ahead to go, but the indications are with the talent that D'Antonio is bringing in that the off-season problems may not have been hurting the Spartans in that way. I think in regards to this game, though, you hit all the points. And I think, you know, the Spartans, are they a little Jekyll and Hyde? I mean, last week we saw the Spartans play as close to, you know, the best game that they played all year. They were even better, I would say, than in the first two games when they played, you know, lesser competition in Western Michigan and Bowling Green. If the Spartans come out, you know, you mentioned that Notre Dame game, but one of the killers in that game were the turnovers. The Spartans gift-wrapped about 21 points to the Irish. And so in that game, if you go back to it, if the Spartans protect the ball, they might have still lost to Notre Dame, but it might have been maybe a three-point loss instead of 20 points or whatever it was. And so if the Spartans go out there and fumble the ball all over there, you know, then Michigan's going to come away with a 20-point win. But, you know, if the Spartans, you know, defense plays well and Lewerke is smart with the ball, the offensive line run blocks and blocks for Lewerke. He makes some passes. He makes some plays. The biggest thing is that I think if the Spartans can come out and score 7 to 10 points in the first quarter and Michigan doesn't answer on the first two or three possessions, now you have the makings of a game. If the Spartans can somehow have a lead at halftime, you know, maybe 13-7 or something, now you're talking about an interesting second half, and it would be not a guarantee, but the Spartans might have a shot at upsetting Michigan if it's looking like that going into halftime.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I know for sure is that the Spartans won't have to worry about crowd noise in Ann Arbor. Michigan State, the big house is one of the – I mean, if you're looking for peace and quiet to study in Ann Arbor, you just go to the football game. You don't have to worry about that.
Students attending the game should bring their textbooks.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, there's more of a threat to be disturbed by a contact high at the game than there is by noise. It's just
– from all the Sharpies, right?
Exactly, from all the Sharpies. I agree. If Michigan State can keep this game close, the game has to be played in the teens, right? The moment this game gets into the 20s, it's not Michigan State's game. Michigan State did suffer one setback, DB, when Jim Harbaugh came to his senses and announced John O'Korn, or whatever his name is, would be John O'Korn, I think his name, but I don't really care. It sounds like a squirrel's name, O'Korn. But it would be the starting quarterback for the University of Michigan. And he's actually the right starting quarterback for him. Wilton Spates is terrible. I was really hoping Wilton Spates would start against Michigan State. And he had to go and get injured. And so that's just the point. Because Wilton Spates was like guaranteed two interceptions. you knew he was going to throw the ball to a Michigan State player at least twice in a game, and all you had to do was catch it. And with O'Korn, you have no such certainty. So I think that's actually an upgrade on the quarterback situation there. The other thing, DB, that I sort of worry about is when you take a look at position by position, depth by depth, all of this sort of stuff, I sort of worry about what happens if Lewerke gets injured, DB, because I've got no confidence beyond that in the quarterback position.
Oh, yeah, well, I don't think we want to think about that because, look, Damian Terry is not all that. And no offense to Damian Terry, but I just wouldn't – yeah, I'd hate to think of it. And DeWeaver and whoever else, they're not ready for prime time yet. So you'd be throwing somebody into the fire.
Yeah.
What's that?
Okay. Yeah, Lewerke's not ready for prime time, let alone Terry or DeWeaver.
Lewerke's a little closer to prime time than those other guys. I mean, he's started to get the experience. I think after the season, Lewerke will be a lot closer to ready to prime time.
To me, Lewerke's like in your 3:30 start games, right? So he's progressed beyond the noon starts. he's ready for 3:30. And by the end of the season, he'll be ready for prime time. So I think we're sort of agreed. Michigan probably wins this game, but if the game is in the teens, Michigan State's got a chance.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if we're, like I said, if we're talking about the Spartans leading at halftime, not a guarantee, because Michigan could come out and blow the doors off in the second half, but if the Spartans have a lead at halftime, and then that third quarter swings the Spartans' way, if the Spartans can get themselves into 20-point territory, beyond 21 or 24, we got a game, and that's a possible upset right there.
Yeah.
The Spartans are sort of stuck at 7 to 10 points late in the third quarter. I don't think it's going to happen.
No, I think Michigan State needs to score at least 16 to win the game. If they get to 16, they've got a legit shot of winning the game. And they cannot turn the ball over against this Michigan defensive unit, because the only way Michigan scores on a consistent basis against this Michigan State team is if they get turnovers. And so if Michigan State can stay even on the turnover battle, they've got a shot. So I don't feel terrible about the game. I don't feel optimistic about the game. I'm sort of in between. But I am going to watch the game eagerly just to benchmark this Michigan State team and see where they are in terms of progress. A win is fantastic. A loss isn't the end of the world. But I want to see where they are in terms of the progress they've made. And that's what I'm really looking for out of this game.
Yeah, I agree. Let's see how they play, even if it is a defeat, which I think it probably is. If the Spartans lose the game by, 3, 6, 10 points, but they played really well and, a few mistakes here and there or whatever. The other thing is emotions and penalties. The Spartans have to go out there and not let the crowd affect them and not let the rivalry affect them and play mistake-free and largely penalty-free, which is hard to do in a rivalry game because the officials call everything in rivalry games. So the Spartans have to eliminate the unnecessary penalties, the holding and the, any cheap shots on defense. And, there's going to be a temptation both ways to hit somebody. It always happens. But, to try to avoid that, especially – in critical situations, if you're going to deck Michigan, if you're down by 20, then start decking Michigan. I mean, whatever,
I agreed on that. All right. Quick podcast today. So let's shift gears a little bit. The new hockey arena, DB, opened up in Detroit.
Yeah.
And I call it the new hockey arena, and calling it the new hockey arena is going to cause some Pistons fans and some agita among Pistons fans and that sort of thing. But one of the complaints about this arena is that It doesn't feel like a Detroit Pistons arena. It feels like a hockey arena and a hockey rink. And not surprising, because it was designed for the Red Wings. It wasn't designed for the Pistons. The Pistons sort of were joined in almost as an afterthought, really late in the process. So the new hockey arena opened up. And, DB, you took in the first game on TV. What did you think of the arena?
Well, I really liked the look of it. NBC Sports Network did the game with Doc and Ed and Pierre McGuire, and they had the cameras all over that place, and you couldn't miss any of it. I love the Red Wing look of it. I love the atrium area. I love the outside. I love the inside. The gondola seats are incredible. If you have vertigo or fear of heights, you don't want to sit up there. You're literally right above the rink. The seats are nice and red. The whole arena reminds me of sort of a cross between sort of Joe Louis Arena and Toronto's arena, Air Canada Center, which is kind of unique, and even a little splash of Olympia. It's on steroids. And I love the look of it. So the Spartan hockey team plays there for their, you know, regular season games against Michigan and the GLI. They're going to enjoy that, I'm sure. It's state-of-the-art. It has raised the bar on hockey arenas. You're going to see teams that who have arenas that aren't that old. They'll take a look at this arena and go, oh man, we need to start updating or build new arenas. Like that's where we're now headed with this. So it's Detroit, you know, the Illich family should be very, very proud of that.
Yeah, I mean, they should definitely be proud of it. And if you guys are wondering what the noise in the background is, I've been kicked out of the conference room I was supposed to be doing this in, and so I'm podcasting from the mean streets of Las Vegas. So any ambient sounds you get is the ambient sound of Sin City. They're going to love the locker rooms, right? The locker rooms are fantastic. The food, the professional chefs. Fans are going to love the big, wide concourses and the bathrooms, but all of that stuff is going to be fantastic. But Joe Louis Arena, it seems to me like it has a Yankee Stadium problem. And anybody that watches baseball or has been to the new Yankee Stadium knows what I'm talking about. If you go to Yankee Stadium for a game, or if you watch a game on TV, the most expensive seats, of which there are several hundred, if not a thousand, are empty most of the time, and they're right by the field. And if you wander down in the seventh or eighth inning to try and sit in one of those seats, they won't let you. They want that. They would rather have those seats be empty and seen empty on TV and be empty in the stadium than let you sit in them for two innings, because they want to maintain that air of expensiveness and exclusivity. And so this is actually really problematic from a TV standpoint, DB, because most hockey arenas don't do this. They want butts in the seats, and they want it to look good on TV. But it looks like Detroit's going the other way with extremely high ticket prices for these particular seats, and it looks like they're just going to remain empty and that's all there is to it. It's a really weird situation.
Yeah. You know what? I was thinking about the seat thing today, and I have a solution to this, and I wish the NHL, because the NHL, by the way, as you know, they do play a role in setting these ticket prices with the teams. And as a fan, I've given up going to NHL games. I've looked on StubHub at some of the various teams all across the NHL, not just the Wings, and unless you're talking about like the Carolina Hurricanes or the Florida Panthers or the Avalanche now, which is, by the way, very sad. The Avalanche ticket prices are pretty low because they're just not what they were. But when I look at the ticket prices for the average fan, hundreds of dollars to sit in the really good seats, I don't want to sit far away. Forget it. I mean, I'd rather go see college hockey or minor league hockey. My time to go to Little Caesars Arena someday will probably be for a GLI or a Spartan, you know, Wolverine game. I don't want to go down there for the Wings first until it settles down. But one thought I had on the ticket thing was, it would be great if they would have the season ticket holders, like in the first 10 to 20 rows in that lower deck, have a checkout system. And what that means is you sort of punch out, like, okay, I'm done. You sign out with your phone with the usher. They scan it. And then people that are in the other seats, especially in the upper deck, could sign up and get a text alert when a couple seats become available, and they come down and check in and sit there during the game. I think that that would be a nice thing to do, you know, where the season ticket holder says, I've left for the night, whatever it is, come on down, and you sign up, and it's just sort of like you get a text during the game, sort of randomly, and different people can come sit in those seats. You know, I would love to see that in all the NHL arenas, but it's really bad for the Red Wings, Satchmo, because you remember this, for the last few seasons in the Joe, it was really the same kind of thing going on. The seats, very empty a lot, only those upper bowl seats. And I think part of it is the price. You're right. I had not thought about that. But part of it is I'm starting to wonder about Detroit hockey fans. Are Detroit hockey fans sort of getting a little, laissez-faire? I mean, this is the first game in this arena, and I feel like the bus should have been in the seats the whole night, just taking that in.
Yeah, see, I have this working theory on Detroit hockey fans that goes back a ways, which is I think somewhere around 2007 or 8, or maybe even 2005 or 6, the attitude of Detroit hockey fans shifted to wake me up when we're in the Stanley Cup final. And unless the Wings are there, they don't care. They're not interested in going down. They're not interested in going down for regular season games. They're not interested in the first two rounds of the playoffs. They're wake me up when we hit the Stanley Cup Finals. And now that they know that this team isn't going to play for a Stanley Cup Final, isn't going to compete, they're even less interested in going. And so I think Red Wings fans became spoiled, and now they're apathetic. And let me know when we're in the Stanley Cup Finals. And until then, forget about it. I really think that's where we're at, and it makes us different than other hockey towns, I suppose. That level of success that we had, people take for granted, and It's just you're not guaranteed to have that level of success. And I don't think Red Wings fans have woken up to that concept. I think the other thing that's happening, DB, is if you go back and you look at those old Red Wing things, like Red Wings fans like to think of themselves as diehard hockey fans. And I'm not sure that's the case anymore. And I think there are sort of two points that I can point out to this. One is those old hockey teams at the Red Wings, they were star-studded, right? There were players that you could fall in love with and you wanted to go see at the arena, and that's just not the case anymore. The other thing is look at the NHL ratings, the NHL playoff ratings, DB, when Detroit's not in the playoffs or not playing. They're not that high in the Detroit area. They're not that high in the Detroit market. So it's not like you've got diehard hockey fans that are tuning in to watch Pittsburgh play Chicago or something like that. Detroit fans don't care. And so I think Detroit fans have become a little provincial about their hockey. They've become a little apathetic. And there are no stars to speak of for these folks to root for. And so, as a result, I think they've largely tuned them out.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think Wings fans have gotten apathetic. I think that they're not hungry anymore. I think there was a lot of hunger. Detroit, the heyday of Detroit hockey town was probably, you know, from that period of the late 80s all through the 90s and the early 2000s. And I think it kind of waned. And Detroit sports fans changed. And I think, you know, there's this hunger and passion for the Lions. You know, they're probably the it team in town. And I think that, you know, the Tigers are now going to go through a rough period, so people are going to back off of that. But to the point that you were talking about the Pistons, I think there's renewed interest in the NBA again. And we were talking offline, and let's see if you agree with this, but I think the Pistons, when they start playing in their regular season games, the Bucks will be in the seats in that arena. I think people are really going to be even more excited for Pistons basketball in that arena than the Wings.
Oh, I agree. The Pistons are the better basketball team. I think one of the things that people became enamored with this, this sense of Detroit as a hockey town. If you remember back then, the Wings were the only Detroit franchise really doing well. I mean, the Pistons had their moments in the late 80s, early 90s, but then the Wings took over and dominated the town for 15, 20 years. But the reason they dominated the town, they were the only team in town winning. And now that the Lions are reasonably good, Michigan State's had a long string of success in basketball and football. Michigan football is back. I almost feel like the Red Wings' place in – it's weird, right, because the Red Wings are one of the iconic franchises in the NHL. But I think in the Detroit area, the Red Wings have been relegated to fourth, fifth, sixth place. And they've got a long ways to go to crawl out of that hole. And I think that's what a lot of this is really about.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, look, you know, the biggest thing with the Wings is, you know, take away whatever the fans, you know, are like. I think that they do need a reason to come watch the team. And the fans are smart, and they know that you know, Ken Holland is not the answer to this team, and the product on the ice is—it's kind of they keep trotting out the same horses every year. And you know, the Wings are lucky if they make the playoffs. I'm not sure that they're a playoff team, and I don't think people are just that excited to go see Henrik Zetterberg anymore. He's a great player. I love Z, but I I love the Wings. And look, I consider myself a really big Red Wings fan, I have to be honest. And I wonder, you know, this is probably a deeper discussion for another day, Tachmo, but for myself, personally, I just feel like with many sports now, with the exception of, like, sitting down and watching a Spartan football game or basketball game, with some of the pro sports, like NHL or what have you, even NFL has a red zone, so I love that when I sit down to watch. I don't really watch whole hockey games in the regular season. I get glued into it in the playoffs, but the highlights are great to watch, especially at NHL.com. And I don't want to sit there and watch the whole thing. Now, that's different from going to the game, but the ticket prices factor. Do you think attention spans are just starting to lean out of these, or is it just, you know, you see fans in other NHL cities showing up all the time, even in thick and thin? Is this a Detroit thing or what?
Yeah, I think it's a Detroit thing, actually. I really do. I think neglect from the front office has hurt. I think the front office neglected the Red Wings in two ways, right? One is the product on the ice. They completely screwed that up. And then the other is they took for granted that the passion Detroit had for hockey was self-sustaining. And it's nowhere close to self-sustaining. And right now, if you were to do a survey of Detroit area sports fans, in terms of their affinity for the teams, the Lions would probably be number one. And the Lions were probably always number one, right? They just weren't winning. The Lions would probably be number one. Michigan football, number two. Michigan State football, three. As we have car alarms going off everywhere on Earth, off this thing. And so you've got that going on as well. And so, yeah, it's just really weird. Hold on, DB. I'm going to mute myself so you can talk for a second here while these car alarms are going off.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, I agree, and I'm agreeing with what you're saying, and you're factoring college sports in there, and I think that you know, you're right. Football is king in the state of Michigan. There's no doubt about that, and I think there is this renewed interest in the NBA. I think people are smart. Having said that, though, you know, the thing is that I really, you know, I look at the traditional hockey towns like Toronto and, you know, Montreal. And now Canada, of course, is crazy about hockey. Doesn't mean they always fill their buildings. I've seen empty seats in Vancouver. But, you know, those fan bases, Chicago gets excited, although I'll say this again, you know, I saw a few games way back in the 90s at the United Center in Chicago, and the state and the arena was half full and was filled with Wings fans, and I was there for a Wings-Hawks game. So fans kind of come and go from teams, and there's only a few, particularly in the NHL, where they really show up all the time. And I've even started, and I think fans can get apathetic. Like, I live in the D.C. area. You've lived here. The Caps in the last 10 years have become a phenomenon. They've become the, one of the most popular teams in town next to the Skins. And yet, with the Caps, I started to notice last season empty seats in their building for some of the games, which you didn't see very much in the seasons before that. And so fan apathy can start to creep in. But Detroit, you know, used to be this hockey town, and they've got hockey town, you know, printed on the ice, but it isn't hockey town. I mean, there's other towns that probably get to have that title first, and it's a shame because when I saw the video during the game of the history, the great job that they did of, you know, bringing the Gordie Howe statue over from the Joe and the little sewer grates with Gordie Howe and Ted Lindsay on it and just all the neat, you know, interactive things that they have in there, recognizing the Wings history, it makes you just realize, gosh, this is a tremendous franchise. I mean, it's got just a great history, and yet it's just sort of sitting here right now stuck in neutral.
Yeah, it's really weird. I feel bad for I'm feeling bad, not the right word, but you're right. The franchise is stuck in neutral. And there's all this young, youthful, energetic talent all around the NHL, and the Red Wings just don't have any of it. And it's hard to feel excited about your team when you see every other team moving forward and your team moving backwards. And I think that's part of it as well. Professional segue, DB. You mentioned Hockey Town and the Hockey Town moniker. One of the things that made Detroit Hockey Town, DB, was Dave Strader. Dave Strader and Mickey Redd, for my money, is the single best hockey announcing booth I have ever seen or heard. I mean, just phenomenal. I can't think of a better booth than Dave Strader and Mickey Redd. And Dave Strader passed away way too young, way too early recently. And there was a touching tribute to him at the Joe last during the first game.
Yeah, you know what? Strader was suffering from cancer for a long time, and I don't think anyone realized that until last season. It was noticed that he wasn't calling a lot of games, and then it was revealed that he was battling cancer, and he was 62, I believe. And you're right, Satchmo, and I remember, you know, when the Wings were first sort of early in the Illich years, and they used to do a simulcast, because they were a little bit low budget, they would have the radio broadcast, which was tremendous also back in the day. I mean, Bruce Martin was the Ernie Harwell of Red Wings hockey. I mean, he was great with that baritone voice he had, and Sid Abel would complain, and, you know, he was part of the production line. They used to just simulcast that on TV, which was kind of cheesy and low budget, and then they finally realized, you know, we need to have a real TV crew here. And so along comes this young guy named Dave Strader. And then they bring Mickey Redman. They sign him away from Hockey Night in Canada to you know, come back to Detroit and be the broadcast booth. And that was the team for a long time. They were, just for a decade, they were tremendous. And then Strader went on to bigger things, you know, broadcasting with NBC and ESPN, and Mickey's still there. And I have to say, when I reflect on any professional sports team's broadcasters, but particularly hockey, and in Detroit sports, the Wings have had really the most consistent, longest-lasting, and probably best broadcasters. I mean, when you think about Strader and Kenny Daniels that followed him is great, and Mickey is great. And then, you know, the radio team of Ken Cal now and Paul Woods is great, and preceded, you know, the Bruce Martin was great, and Bud Lynch back in the day. Just great broadcasters, and Strader was part of that. And, gosh, he you know, you just sort of took it for granted that he would call a lot of the game. He wasn't the A-team person on NBC, but he was right. He was A-minus. I mean, it was right after Doc calling the conference finals for the Western Conference, and he will certainly be missed, Satchmo. It's just hockey won't seem the same without him.
Yeah, he had a golden voice, and he had a gift for language. Not the Doc Emmer's gift for language, but he had a gift for language. He knew how to set up his analyst, and he never missed a call, DB. He never missed a call. I mean, and there are all sorts of funny stories about announcers missing a call. Like, if you remember Harry Carey, his shtick was spelling names backwards. And I remember one call where he was spelling Ichiro backwards or something like that. And you hear the crack of the bat and the ball fly, and you know the ball's in play, and you know something exciting is happening because the crowd is going nuts. And Harry Carey is still spelling Ichiro backwards. And which is sort of a funny Harry Carey story, right? But Dave Strader was the exact opposite of that. He got every call right. He got, if the puck was in the corner, he knew the two players are digging after it in the corner. I rarely saw him miss a deflection. I mean, he just knew, and he was outstanding, and he had a gift for big moments. If there are basically two hockey announcers I'd want to hear doing a big game in my lifetime, they were Doc Emmerich and Dave Strader. Those are the only two I'd want on the call.
The other great thing I totally agree. I mean, and, you know, the other thing about the Red Wings and their franchise is that, you know, other franchises haven't had that consistent link back to the past. And the Wings have that, not only with their players, but then also with the broadcasters. I mean, you remember the mess that was created when Bo Schembechler was inexplicably the general manager of the Detroit Tigers, and he fired Ernie Harwell. Well, that was a terrible decision all the way around. But yet the Wings have never fallen into a situation like that. I mean, when Bruce Martin retired, he quietly handed the baton to Ken Cal. And then, in fact, when the Wings were in the 1997 Stanley Cup Finals and they finally, you know, won a cup for the first time in 50-some-odd years, the second period of that game and the ultimate game-winning goal, Game 4, at the Joe, scored by Darren McCarty, was called by Bruce Martin. Ken allowed Bruce, who did not ever get to call a Wings Cup final, and all the years of broadcasting, I don't believe, got to come back and call the second period at Ken's request of that game 4. And I listened to it on the radio, and that was just wonderful to hear that. It was just, there was this linkage to the past, and the Wings do that very well with their family and their alumni and their broadcasters, and they're to be credited for that. And Dave Strader is part of that history, and they should create a Dave Strader statue and a broadcasting wing at the new arena. You know, they really should. I mean, of all those guys. I mean, it really is just they're just tremendous. All of them are great.
I agree that all of them are great. All right. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about Dave, which is really cool. The one thing I wanted to touch on before we get off the arena, then we move on to sort of close the show, is that Pistons fans are grumbling. I wouldn't even say Pistons fans. Pistons are grumbling about the arena, DC, being very hockey-centric, very Red Wing-friendly. And, when they put the basketball court out and all that sort of stuff, it looks like a quality basketball. It looks like an NBA arena. But the amenities, everything being sort of Red Wing-friendly, is there a legitimate beef there?
Yeah, a little bit. I don't know how to view that relationship, right? I mean, you know, it is the Ilitches and Little Caesars that built that arena, and it is very Red Wing-centric. I don't know this, but I assume there's got to be Pistons stuff in there. I mean, when you know, they'll switch the banners up in the ceiling, you know, for each, you know, they do that when there's multi-purpose arenas. We haven't really had this relationship with the Wings and the Pistons ever, right? I mean, the Wings always played in the Joe and the Olympia, and the Pistons had moments where they, you know, had to play some games in the Joe once or twice, but they played at Cobo Arena way back in the day when they were last in Detroit, and then it was the Silver Dome and then the Palace. So we haven't had this relationship, and they've been rivals. I mean, they compete for the same crowds and the same audiences, and there's no secret that the two organizations are rivals in a way. And so now you're putting them together in the same building, and I can see where the Pistons are going to have a little chip on their shoulder.
Yeah, well, they do change the banners out for basketball games, right? The Red Wings banners come down as the Pistons banners go up. They do that, but I've heard even, like, hockey fans saying, oh, I wish the Pistons weren't playing. And that's a really interesting sentiment, DB, with fans being unhappy that it's a dual-use arena.
Yeah, you know, that is interesting. I guess, you know, I'm going to wait and see. I mean, I hope that they've created, you know, because the Pistons don't have a home anymore. I mean, that was the Palace, and they gave that up to go down there. And that was their decision to do that. But, and it's certainly, you know, it's a decision you have to take that decision. I mean, you know, it's a great thing for the Pistons to be back in downtown Detroit. No offense to the Palace. It was a wonderful building. But, you know, at the same time, though, I do hope that they've carried through, you know, the Pistons artifacts into the new arena and their history, too. I mean, it should be divided and shared equally because the Pistons have, while not as long of a history as the Wings, they have had a pretty prominent and successful franchise in Detroit and the NBA.
And let's face it, the Pistons, say what we will, and this can get into a whole another hour-long podcast, but the Pistons have a greater connection to the city of Detroit and the community of Detroit than the Red Wings do in many ways.
Sure. I would agree. And I think that, you know, in regards to the Pistons, I mean, there were times in Detroit's history going back into sort of like the mid-'80s when the Tigers had won the World Series, they were kind of, you know, swinging downward. The Lions were bad. The Wings were, you know, the dead Wings. But the Pistons had Isaiah Thomas and the Microwave, and they were starting to come on, you know. And so there was a period there probably from, like, maybe about 1985 or so up until the early 90s and 92 or so when the Bulls knocked them out. The Pistons were probably, and you tell me this, Satchmo, could have been the number one team in town. They were the team. I would say.
Yeah, during mm-hmm. during the Bad Boys era, they were definitely the number one team in town.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And then the Wings the people turned their attention to the Red Wings after that. But, the Pistons were the thing. I used to watch the Pistons a ton back then.
And the Pistons fan base would be energized by that movie back downtown, too. So, I would not be surprised if, at least for the next few years, that arena in the city of Detroit is more of a basketball town than a hockey town for a little while.
There's a lot more to cheer for. I mean, the Pistons
have
a chance. I mean, the Pistons could be in the playoffs. I mean, they're next to the Lions. The Pistons are the next team to kind of get excited about in the city.
Yeah, and let's face it. I could suit up for an Eastern Conference team right now and they'd have a chance to make the playoffs.
it's not too hard. Unless your name is Cavaliers or Celtics. And then even if it is, there's this thing called the Western Conference and you're probably just going to get spanked by, you know, filling the blank with Warriors, Rockets, Oklahoma City, whoever.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's see. How much time do you have left to do?
Well, let's take about 5 more minutes because, Satchmo, you're in Las Vegas. And, of course, that's the scene of the one of the worst shooting tragedies in our nation's history. And it's another terrible tragedy. But this one was especially sinister. And, of course, everybody knows about it right now. But tell us about the mood. You sort of got there after this happened this week. And just tell us what things have sort of felt like and what you sort of observed this week about Las Vegas.
Yeah, so Las Vegas is an interesting city. This shooting is, like, it's almost like the worst place, and if there is such a thing as the best place for this sort of thing to happen, it's like the worst place and the best place for this sort of thing to happen. And let me explain that, because I'm not trying to be an insensitive jerk about this. And I'm not being an insensitive jerk. This is not my first brush with mass attacks or terrorist attacks or anything like that. And so I've had to go through this a couple of times. But the reason I say that is twofold. So in a sense, Las Vegas is set up for attacks like this. High rises everywhere, all overlooking large public spaces, right? If you can knock out the window at any one of these places, get a high caliber gun, a sniper, whatever you want to do it, and start shooting and inflict heavy casualties in a lot of different places in Vegas. And so in that sense, it's sort of a scary city when you think about this sort of attack. On the other hand, it's almost good that the attack happened here rather than somewhere else. And I say that for two reasons. Assuming an attack like this is inevitable, which I'm not sure I'm willing to make that assumption, but assuming an attack like this is inevitable, the reason I say that is, one, is there's security cameras everywhere. This is one of the most secure cities in the world. It's one of the safest cities in the world. And because of the security presence, because of the security cameras, they were able to figure out what was going on quickly, and they were able to learn a lot about this person quickly, the person that did the shooting. And I just won't name him because I don't want to give him that sort of publicity. And so they were able to learn about him and quickly figure out what's going on. And the other reason I say that is because this is a city with a gun culture, not just a city, a state with a gun culture, DB. And so they take a look at something like this. If something like this happens in Connecticut or New Jersey or something like that, everyone's going, why did this happen here? I can't believe this happened. What kind of culture do we live in? What type of society do we live in? And that's actually a lot of the reaction that's happening nationwide. The reaction in Nevada is a bit different. They're like, well, yeah, hey, dude's a bad guy, evil stuff happens. You can't regulate evil out of existence. We've got to move on. And so there's a sort of life moves on quality to this here in Vegas right now. You've got people that are worried about the impact on the tourism industry. And let me tell you, a lot of people cancel trips, DB. A lot of people cancel trips to Vegas, which I never understand, which is what these people want, right? These people that inflict these mass attacks, they want you to react like this. So I don't understand why people do it, but that's what they do. Right? And so a lot of trips, because we have a lot of people worried about the tourism industry here. You've got a lot of people, you know, just in sort of somber, quiet, reflective moods. So the locals are sort of more somber, quiet, reflective, but they're going on with their business and they're going on and doing their thing. The tourists that are here, DB, they're out. They're gambling. They're partying. They're drinking. They're going to clubs. And so it's a different vibe for them. It's almost like the attack didn't happen. And so you've got that vibe going on here as well. So you've got these different feelings there. And so the other sort of interesting thing that I think in all of this is, for a lot of people, when they see an attack on New York City or they see an attack on Washington, D.C., they don't really have a connection to the city. So for them, that's an attack on the country, and that's how they process the attack. Their country's been attacked. Time to go get this person. When they see an attack on Las Vegas, this is a city that so many people have either been to or want to go to that this attack feels much more personal to them. This is their city. Even if they don't live here or have only been here a couple times or have only been here once, right, this is their city in a way that New York or Washington, D.C. will never be. And so their connection to this city makes their reaction to these attacks much different and much more profound, taken much more personally. And there's a sense that's like, wow, if it can happen in Vegas, it can happen everywhere, right? Whereas an attack in D.C. or New York just doesn't feel nearly as personal. And so if you talk to out-of-towners and people who say Vegas is my town now, you get that sense. And then for the people that were here during the attack, and look, I've talked to a lot of them. I mean, I've talked to a lot of them. It's been an emotional week. When the attacks were going on, they're, depending on where you were, emotions range, right? If you were far away from the attack, yeah, it was scary, but you knew nothing was going to happen to you. And so you're like, all right, let's stay safe and let's let friends and family know we're okay and hope for the best. And but if you were in the area, in the vicinity where you were being forced to shelter in place and not go near windows and couldn't go back to your room and any of that sort of stuff, it was a lot scarier situation. And it forces you to sort of take stock of your life and stock of society and say, all right, how do we make things better? And so, yeah, I think Vegas, in some ways, Vegas is a different city since the attack, but in most ways, Vegas is exactly the same. And that's because the people and the ethos of this city and this state are more uniquely suited to handle and process this than almost any other place in the country.
Interesting thoughts. You know, our minds have been on Las Vegas this week, and I mean, on the one hand, it's understandable that people wouldn't go. On the other hand, it shows resiliency, and it's a city with character, and it's our hope that, gosh, it seems like these incidents continue, and each one seems to get worse, and we hope maybe at some point we won't be on a podcast talking about these things. Unfortunately, they keep popping up.
Yeah, I'm getting tired of this, right? I'm getting tired of comedians having to come on and talk about this. I'm getting tired of us having to come on and talk about this. I mean, this stuff needs to end, right? It's ridiculous that this happens over and over again. And I am not one to shrug my shoulders and say, well, bad stuff happened. We can't do anything about it. Let's not talk about this and move on to the next thing. No. This needs to be talked about. And this needs to be discussed. And this is, bad stuff happens. But you want to know what? We can make it harder for bad stuff to happen. And what that make it harder for bad stuff to happen is, I don't know. But the idea that we can't even talk about it just bothers me. And that, more than anything else, needs to change. And once we move to a place where we can talk about this, we can legitimately talk about this, and we can say, all right, what do we do about these sorts of things? Because you want to know what? Go back to Columbine, 1998? Is that when Columbine was?
1999.
Yeah, 1999. This has been going on for way too long, for far too long. Mass killings have killed more people in this country than any other attack, right? No, it's got to – there's been too much of this disease. It needs to stop. It really does. And if we can find ways to work together on other problems, and let's face it, we're not really good at doing that either, but at least efforts are made. If we can make the effort to find a way to work on other issues, then we have to at least try to talk our way through this and figure out how to solve it, because throwing your hands up in there and saying, well, there's nothing we can do about it, that just doesn't cut it, not at this point.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think as a country, it starts with the people that lead the country to really start leading and not let special interests or anyone else lead it. That's not the answer. One life lost to gun violence is one life too many. It's not just this shooting. It happens every day in a lot of cities and a lot of places, and it's happening too much. And it is a public health crisis. I agree.
Yeah. And at a minimum, we should be able to agree on that, right? At a minimum, we should be able to agree on that, that it's happening too often and we have to do something about it. And my biggest problem is there are people that don't want to agree on that. And if you don't want to agree on the fact that it's happening too often and we need to think about doing something about it, then what's the point of public discourse? I mean, really, what's the point? But on that note, I guess I agree.
We'll
get back to this another time. I want to end the podcast there, but I want to tie this back to these last thing, Divya, because I don't know if you saw the reports about threats being made against Michigan State sporting events.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, so that came out today, and so I just want to tie this whole thing into it. Please keep going to the game. Don't let these threats scare you. The police are investigating, are on top of it. Go about your daily business. Go about your normal business. The only way these people win is if we start changing who we are and what we do. Every day that we do what we normally do, every day that we fly someplace and go on vacation, every day that we go to a conference, every day that we get up and go to work and not spend a minute thinking about these types of people, every day that we go to a football game and watch the game like there's nothing going on, those are the days we win and they lose. The more time, thought, and energy we put into worrying about what's going to happen at these games, that's when they win. So I understand the fear and I understand it, but my heartfelt advice would be, and DB, you know me, I've been through 9/11, I've been through other stuff. Go about your daily business, live your life. Don't let fear win. Just go out and live your life. There are threats being made on Michigan State sporting events. Go to the games, watch the games, let the police do their job, let the intelligence agencies do your job, but most important, live your life. Living your life is the biggest victory that you can have, and it's every day you live your life is a defeat for people who dare attack.
Right. I agree. I think on that note, that's a good place to leave it for today.
All right, the fight song will play us out. Go State. All white unis, DB. Hopefully they work this time.
Absolutely. Go Spartan.
All right, until next week, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.